Good morning, and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Well, according to a multi-country survey conducted by Nokia, the big cell phone maker, 93% of people say that they get lost on a regular basis. One out of 10 have missed a job interview and have missed an important business meeting. They've missed a flight because they lost their way. Why is it that, unlike so many of our fellow creatures, human beings are really bad navigators? We get lost more easily than any other animal. We will see if we can get some answers this morning as we talk with Colin Ellard. He's an experimental psychologist at the University of Waterloo. This is in Ontario, Canada, and he is an international expert in the psychology of navigation. He is the author of a very interesting new book that you can find in the bookstore. Now, the title of his book is You Are Here, the subtitle, Why We Can Find Our Way to the Moon But Get Lost in the Mall. And it does take a look at how it is that human beings and other animals navigate, and also how it is that we find our way in the built environment, why it is that maybe some spaces feel more comfortable or more easy to navigate than others. And he has some very interesting things to say between all of this and how these things connect with, say, our attitudes towards the environment and maybe sometimes our inability to take seriously things like the way that we live and the way that it affects the environment and maybe even leads to environmental degradation. So as we talk in this part of Focus 580, questions are certainly welcome. We ask only people keep their comments, questions brief and on topic. But otherwise, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455, that's the Champaign-Urbana number. So for local folks, use that number. But if it would be a long-distance call, use the other one, the toll-free, and that is 800-222-9455. And at any point here, certainly you pick up the telephone and give us a call. Professor Ellard, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Was there some particular thing, I guess I'm curious to start out with, that drew you into this as being a major focus of your research, that is the psychology of navigation?
Yeah, it's an interest that kind of sprang from earlier work that I had done in animal behavior. My ancient history really is in that field, and I spent many years trying to understand how it is that animals found their way from one place to another. And I was dealing with a wide range of different kinds of questions, from stories about the legendary fantastic navigators, you know, animals like monarch butterflies and sea turtles and migrating birds that we know find their way accurately over thousands of miles, to even kind of, you know, what you might think of as ordinary run-of-the-mill kinds of animals, like even laboratory rodents, solving kinds of everyday tasks like finding food and avoiding predation. And at some point along the way, I began to think about how the work that I was doing with animals might relate to human navigation. And I had this kind of intuition based on mostly stories, anecdotal evidence, that there might be some really fundamental differences between us and the other animals that I'd studied. My sense was that we tend to be quite a bit more uncertain much of the time about exactly where it is that we are. And when I began to do some laboratory experiments to look at this, it turned out to be exactly that to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about some of what's in this first section about how humans and other animals navigate space. And it would seem that if you start at the very simplest level, what you're talking about is we see where we want to go, and then we go there. And it seems like it should be fairly easy. I think in the book, you get people to think about the example of being in the grocery store, and you're in the one end of the aisle, and you want to buy cereal. And then you see it's down to the other end of the aisle, so you just go there. And maybe, though, that's making that process of seeing where you want to go and going there easier than it actually is.
Well, it, in comparison with some of the other kinds of problems that, that both we and other kinds of animals have to solve, in some ways it is simple, but it's important to bear in mind that in terms of the brain architecture that's required to even solve a quite a simple problem like that can be quite formidable. Once you get into the problems that we have of coordinating different parts of our body, correlating what our eyes are doing with what our feet and our hands are doing, then even a very simple task like reaching out to grasp a cup of coffee can involve a fair amount of processing. But that's really, you know, as you say, that's at the beginning of my book that I describe those kinds of problems. And then as I progress, I begin to describe problems that involve our finding our way from where we are to things that we may not be able to see. So, for example, trying to find your way from one place to another at urban scale in a city is a much more difficult wayfinding problem than finding a box of cereal at the grocery store, and a very interesting problem as well.
So, going to that next level, you're saying, well, what do you do if you're trying to get someplace and you can't see the target? What seems to be the obvious answer is, at least one answer is, and this is something that people do, and it turns out animals do too, you go by landmarks.
Yes. There's a wide range of different kinds of strategies that we can use to find our way from one place to another that can often vary depending on the kind of context that you find yourself in. So in very many cases, the best strategy is to try to find your way using landmarks, and there are different ways that could work. You know, you could imagine in a city that has a very large and stable landmark, for example, a very tall building or a mountain range that's off in the distance, and you can almost use something like that as a compass. So wherever you are, you can orient yourself by that compass to some extent. There might be other circumstances, though, where you don't have that kind of landmark available to you, and you might be more dependent on more subtle local landmarks. So if you think, for example, of how you might give somebody directions to get from one place to another, you would often couch your directions in terms of a sequence of things that they should look for, a sequence of these local landmarks. And that's something that can also work well if you know the terrain very well. There are other circumstances where you might use something entirely different, and this is something that I think there's tremendous variability in human beings and our ability to do this, and that's one of the things that I find really quite fascinating about wayfinding and sense of direction is that variability. Some people can quite effectively use cardinal directions, so they seem to be quite good at keeping some kind of sense of north, south, east, and west. And that's a kind of strategy that can work, again, can work really well in certain kinds of contexts and maybe not as well in others. And I'm thinking now of something like different styles of city organization. And this is something that I talk about towards the end of the book. I compare something that we're very familiar with in North America, which is the grid style of city. Think of something like a Manhattan as an extreme example, where all of the streets are, or most of the streets are aligned with the cardinal directions. In a city like that, it can be a tractable problem to find your way by trying to keep some kind of mental sense of direction. But if you contrast that with a city with a more kind of sinuous, organic form, like an older city like a London or a Paris, you can easily imagine that trying to find your way by keeping track of the cardinal directions, the compass directions, would be a much more difficult proposition. Yeah. So it's often when people become lost, let's say, for example, if you're going on vacation and you're visiting a city that you've never been to before, it can often have to do with you're trying to adopt a style of navigation that you might be familiar with from your home turf to another context where maybe it doesn't work as well.
Well, this and maybe is jumping ahead a little bit, but since you raised the point, I think that it's really interesting, and this is something I know from having read the book, although I guess I'm not sure why this is, and you can explain it, and that is why it is that human beings seem to be pretty good, I guess this is the way I would say it, they're pretty good at straight lines, but they're not real good at curves.
Yeah, that That's really interesting, and it's you're absolutely right. That's one of the things that we tend not to handle mentally very well when we're trying to build kind of a brain map of space. The two things that tend to distort our geometry the most when we're mentally representing space are that we straighten curves. And we regularize intersections. All I mean by that is that if there's where two streets meet at a kind of an odd angle, in our mental map of that space, we tend to straighten everything out to make those streets intersect north-south and east-west. And the main reason that I think we do those things is because our minds are constantly trying to find ways to simplify or to schematize maps of space. So it's almost as if we're adopting a kind of a mental shorthand to help us to remember how a space is organized. And for some purposes, that kind of schematic map of space is going to work wonderfully well. So if you think of something like a subway map, for example, lots of subway maps you'll notice don't really reflect true geometry very well at all. They consist of what a mathematician would describe as a topology, and all that means is that what's emphasized is a series of nodes, where the nodes would be the stations and the connections between the nodes. And it doesn't really matter very much if you're on the subway to know how far it is between the nodes in real dimensions, and it doesn't really matter what the angles might be between the different tracks in a complex subway system. That doesn't affect our ability to get from one place to another. And in the same way, I think that we often mentally represent spaces as the same kinds of topologies, especially in cities, because, again, you've got so much wayfinding support in a city, and you're constrained. You know, you can only go in certain directions, that we can get away with ignoring that geometry and just using a topology. So we schematize, we simplify space, and in many cases that can work for us. It's only when we become lost that suddenly all of that can fall apart, when we need the geometry to find our way back, and we don't have it.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Colin Ellard. He's an experimental psychologist at University of Waterloo. That's in Canada, in Ontario, Canada. He is an international expert in the psychology of navigation, and it is something that he writes about in his recent book, You Are Here, the subtitle, Why We Can Find Our Way to the Moon, Get Lost in the Mall, published by Doubleday. It's very interesting. So you can seek it out. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. To return for a moment to the subject of landmarks and navigating by landmarks, so one of the things that you write about in the book is that it seems that maybe some people who seem to have a great sense of direction are very good navigators. What's really going on here is what they are is very good observers of the environment. And what they are doing is they're, in a sense, they're going by landmarks, but it could be things that are so subtle that I wouldn't see them, you wouldn't see them, but they can see them.
Yes, David, that's quite true. There are some really fascinating stories of traditional wayfinding cultures. Have been throughout human history for thousands of years, people who are not like us in the sense that for them the consequences of becoming lost could be a very quick death. So if you think of people living in forbidding environments like the Arctic, for example, or the Australian desert, there are people who have lived in environments like that for thousands of years by their wits and have known exactly where they are. And one of the universals that you tend to find in people who've lived under those kinds of conditions is that they have cultivated this exquisite eye for detail, especially visual detail. So they've been able to pick up on all kinds of subtle pieces of information that might not even just be landmarks. A wonderful example from the Inuit wayfinding methods in the Arctic is that they are actually able to use patterns that are formed in the snow by the prevailing directions of winds as a kind of a compass. So in those traditional wayfinding cultures, you find this this very sensitive eye for visual detail. And what I've noticed, and this is more at this point anecdotal because it's something that I haven't had a chance to follow up yet in my laboratory, is that when you talk to people who say that they feel that they have a very good sense of direction, and by the way, one of the remarkable things about sense of direction is that unlike many other aspects of psychology, we tend to know ourselves very well. So if you ask someone, how's your sense of direction, and they say, well, I think it's very good, then typically they're right. We know our own minds and our own behavior for sense of direction maybe better than we do for some other things. So if you ask someone who self-reports as having a very good sense of direction a few questions, then what seems to very quickly emerge is that they do seem to have this very carefully cultivated eye for visual detail. And sometimes it's not just eye. Sometimes other senses become involved as well. And I'm sure that lots of people can think of stories of being able to associate places with particular sounds or even smells that evoke memories for them and help them to realize where they are. So yeah, this ability to be able to pick up on subtle details does seem to be one of the linchpins of a good sense of direction.
We have a caller here in the community of Belgium, not that far away from us. This is line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I haven't heard every word of your conversation this morning, but I hope I'm not going to step on something here. I truly enjoy maps very much like a dictionary, you know. You can wander through everything. It's not necessarily a story by itself. It's just different things. But the different representations we have of maps is really interesting anymore. And the one I'm talking about is one that's on Google called Street Map, where you've taken a map, and then over top of that map, you've overlaid the actual place. So you can, as you drive down the road, you can see both sides of the road or up above or down below. And it's amazingly, you know, a relationship between a map and the physical world. Have you seen that map?
Yeah. Street View, Google Earth and Street View, absolutely fascinating. I resonate completely with what you're saying. I'll tell you a little story about my own behavior, and then I'll kind of comment more generally about this phenomenon. But I, a few days ago, had some curious thoughts about the place where I'd grown up. I was actually born in the suburbs of London, England. And I forget all of the processing that went on now, but at some point I thought, gee, I'm going to go to Google Earth and I'm going to go have a look at the street that I was born on and see how it looks now, just kind of an overhead view. And I discovered to my delight that there is Street View available for the very street on which I was born. And so for anybody who hasn't tried it, basically what happens is that it's a computer interface, and as you get close to the ground, you see these marvelous little bubbles. And if you go into one of these bubbles, then it's as if you are on the street, and you can turn around, look at different directions, examine the houses. And what I noticed about myself is that I had this almost visceral response that even though this was a place that I hadn't visited for, about 40 years, there were things that I remembered that I didn't even know that I had as memories. So I think that there are lessons here. There are all kinds of lessons. One of them is the importance of place to our personal recollections, our autobiography, and that's something that interests me a great deal. And I think, again, this is something that we've been doing for thousands of years. It's one of the ways that we connect ourselves with places is by telling ourselves these stories that connect us with locations. And again, the ancients, the legendary ancient wayfinders use these kinds of methods explicitly. By connecting place with narrative, they found their way. But more generally, one of the things that I love about Google Earth is and other kinds of mapping software like Google Earth is that collectively I think they are showing in very interesting ways this fascination that we have with place. If you think about I'm not sure that I'm probably not typical, but if I think about my own uses of Google Earth, it can be a wonderful practical tool if you're going somewhere and you want to see what the lay of the land is going to be before you get there. But most of my time that I spend with Google Earth is spent in fun. It's because people seem to enjoy having this kind of playful relationship with place and space, and I think that's not only wonderfully fun, but important and interesting as well.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller, and this is someone in Paxton that's on our line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Was wondering if your guest could comment. A couple of quick things here. But I'm wondering if he has a sense of, with the direction and now the onset of the GPS, if he's noticing any sort of a generational thing here where I notice young people, obviously they're more adapted to technology, relying so much on the GPS that, you know, they get in their car and they go two blocks around to get a cup of coffee. So, oh, well, got to turn the GPS on, and I can't get there without my GPS. And then, you know, I'm just bewildered. I'm wondering if we're perhaps not losing something because of this. And then my take, you were talking about sense of direction. I would consider myself just above average. My wife has an excellent sense of direction, but I have relatives, and it's always amazing to me, people have absolutely no sense of direction. And if they're two blocks from their home, they're getting lost. And I don't know if it's, if it's something we're hardwired with or if it's just experiences. But anyway, those are my observations. Wondering if you care to comment. Thanks.
Wonderful questions. There's a lot to talk about here. Let's start with GPS. The viewpoint that the caller is expressing is a common one, and it's an idea that I resonate with to some extent. So the argument is that by developing this kind of over reliance on technology, then we may be making further inroads in the erosion of whatever natural abilities we might have for wayfinding, and that's a problem. And I think that we've all seen examples in the media. Every once in a while, a story comes along of somebody who has disastrously ignored the evidence of their own eyes in favor of what the GPS sees them. So we've seen photographs of people who've almost driven off of cliffs or who have literally driven into buildings because their GPS told them that there was road where there was actually no road, and there can be a number of different reasons for those kinds of errors. And there have actually been people who've made the argument that our over-reliance on this kind of technology may actually be causing changes in the organization of our brain. So there may be some cause for concern about GPS. But now I want to give you the kind of the contrarian point of view on GPS. Now I want to tell you a story, and it has to do with my first purchase of a GPS, which took place, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago. And I bought this machine. I basically bought it for my children. And what I was interested in was a kind of a game called geocaching. I don't know if you've heard of geocaching, but it's basically a something like a scavenger hunt where you can look up on a website a latitude and longitude of a treasure, and then you can go out with your GPS and you can find the treasure. And the treasures consist of little things that people have hidden, like toys or coins or little notes or puzzles. It's basically a game that you play with space. And so the biggest part of my motivation for buying this GPS was that I wanted to engage my children's natural affinity for technology in such a way that I could encourage them to go outdoors and play with space. The geocaching took off a little bit, but one of the most interesting experiences that I had that really made me think a lot about this kind of technology is that not long after we bought the machine, we were going on a long and not very interesting dead straight line car trip. And children were on board, and as children will be on long and boring car trips, they began to complain almost immediately Are we there yet? When are we going to stop? When are we going to take a break? There's nothing to do. So what I did was to flip the GPS to them in the back seat and say, here, take a look at this thing. And what started to happen was that my children turned on the unit, and being tech savvy, they figured out how the whole thing worked in about 5 seconds. And they started to report things from the back seat like, you know, did you notice that we're crossing a river now? And here's the name of the river. And did you know where it goes and where it empties into the sea? And look, you can zoom out and you can see all of these features that connect this river with where we are. And now we're going through a town, and here's the name of this town. And so what I'm driving at here, what I'm trying to illustrate, is that in this case, what was happening was that my children were actually using the technology to turn their attention outwards to space rather than inwards to the machine. So, yes, I think that there is some merited concern about how GPS might erode our spatial sense. But I think, as with almost all technology, it's useful to make a distinction between what a technology is and how that technology is used. And I think that there are marvelous ways that we could use GPS technology to engage ourselves and maybe especially our children playfully with space, to encourage us to think about the problem of space and place and how we deal with it. The other question that you asked was about variability in sense of direction, and that's really very interesting, and that's something that I think we have only just begun to tackle in the scientific sense. And I think what you've said is exactly right. There is a huge range. There are people who seem to profoundly lack sense of direction to the extent that they might even become lost in very familiar spaces like their own homes. At the other end of the scale, I've talked to people and to some extent have had demonstrated to me people with really phenomenal sense of direction. For example, I remember walking around with one fellow, and I talk a bit about him in the book, who told me that he always knows where water is. And I tested him out a bit on this, and he did seem to actually have a very good sense of direction in a fairly labyrinth and city environment. As far as the science is concerned, as to whether there are fundamental differences in brain organization that correlate with that variability, I suspect that there are. We have some small clues as to where those differences might lie. I think that we know very, very little yet about their basis. There's been some speculation that there may be some genetics involved. That wouldn't be that surprising, but as far as I know, there's no evidence for that so far. I think it's very likely as well that there's a role for experience. I notice that people who have grown up, for some reason, people who've grown up in rural settings, of farmers, for example, seem to enjoy a more finely honed sense of direction than the average urban dweller, somebody who's grown up in the city. And I can imagine reasons why that might be so. I can imagine reasons why having a precise understanding of one's location might make more of an important difference for somebody who's grown up in that setting than someone who's grown up in the city. But I don't think we have the scientific facts on that yet. But it's certainly a fascinating question, and one to follow up on, where this variability comes from and how it works. But one thing that I should say is that sometimes when I talk to people who have what they self-report is a not very good sense of direction, it's sometimes possible to teach them some very simple tricks that can help them a lot. I think one of my favorite examples is something called the look back. And the look back it's really stunningly simple when you hear it. In fact, it's a technique that's used by a wide range of different kinds of animals. Even flying insects like wasps will use the look back. And it is exactly what it sounds like. If you're making a foray from some kind of home base, let's say you're in a strange city on vacation, or you're walking through trails in the woods and there's some complicated intersections that you need to understand to find your way back, on your way out, turn around and look back to notice what you'll see on your return. It sounds ridiculously simple, yet oftentimes people haven't really thought about using something simple like the look back, and when they start to use it, they notice that their wayfinding improves a little bit. Another little trick that can work, and I do this with my children. I try to think of ways that I can help them to kind of space-proof yourself, I think you could maybe call it, is to again tap into some of the techniques that were used by the ancients. So if you can find ways to connect places along your travels with some kind of a story, just make something up. This is something that we as human beings are tremendously good at. It's such a natural facility that we have for making up stories about things that happen to us. So imagine that you're walking through a forest and you encounter a tree stump beside the trail. Sit on the tree stump and just spend maybe 10-15 seconds thinking of some kind of snippet of story that maybe connects what you can see from that tree stump. Maybe there's a tree with an odd-shaped trunk, and you can imagine somebody having played with that odd-shaped tree. Even just a few seconds of that kind of thought can absolutely stamp into memory your experience with that location. And this is a technique that has been used with survival schools that try to teach children some wilderness survival tips so that if they do become lost in a forest, let's say, then they have some ideas about how to find their way. And when children have been taught to use this technique with narratives, the amazing finding is that you can take those children back into the woods years later after they've grown up, and they will still remember their roots because they remember the stories. So it's a simple but tremendously powerful technique that people can use to improve their sense of direction.
We are a bit past the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and for anyone who has just tuned in, I'd like to introduce again the guest. Colin Ellard is an experimental psychologist at the University of Waterloo, and that's in Ontario, in Canada. He is an international expert in the psychology of navigation and has been done a lot of research on this subject, and some of what he and others have found you can read in his book, You Are Here. The subtitle is Why We Can Find Our Way to the Moon But Get Lost in the Mall. It's published by Doubleday, and it looks at how it is that various kinds of animals, including human beings, navigate, and some of the differences perhaps between humans and other animals. Something I want to make sure that we get to, he says some very interesting things about how our minds work and how that maybe contributes to the way that we navigate or our failures to navigate. Questions are also welcome. We have a couple of other people here who are standing by, so we'll get to them. Going next to Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. I was really intrigued by your earlier comment that people seem to have problems going in circles, you know? And the reason it triggered something in my thinking is because of the fact that when children are learning to time nowadays, they're not being taught, some of them are not being taught how to read a clock. They're getting digitalized time. But can you say a little bit more about why it is that human beings have problems with walking in circles? Because, I think of traditional cultures, you know, dancing in a circle, the circular style of housing, the cycle of the seasons. I mean, there's just so many ways in which circles are part of our everyday lives and part of our civilization. I'm thinking of the wheel here, you know. I mean, it may sound trivial, but I'm just really intrigued by that comment and would like a little more information.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And that's a new question for me, which is great. Most of the time when I think about people walking in circles, I'll tell you it's something let me just back up a little bit to my earlier comments about how we mentally represent spaces. So in that case, we certainly do seem to straighten out curves. And now I'm talking about those mental maps of space that we seem to have when we're thinking about the spatial relationships of one place to another. And that's quite different to questions about our performance on the ground. One of the things that for example, orienteers know, and anybody who spends time in the woods knows this as well, is that in fact one of the most difficult things for us to do is to actually walk in a straight line through a cluttered environment. And I tell a story actually early on in my book about one of my experiences where I did something that one should never do in wilderness, which is that I left the trail. And I left the trail because I thought I could rely on not a mental map, but a physical map of space that I had that told me that I could make this wonderful shortcut just by walking straight for a distance of maybe 500 yards. And what ended up happening was that I became horribly lost. And the reason that I became horribly lost is because my straight line path ended up being this marvelous curve, in fact, 180-degree change in direction. So I was walking in exactly the opposite direction to the direction that I thought that I had been walking in, which sounds extraordinary. It sounds like there's no way that this could possibly happen. But again, people who've done some trekking in woods know that it can be quite easy for this to happen. So there's a big difference between how we might mentally represent a space and how we might perform on the ground. I think I know that everybody has kind of an intrinsic bias. So if you try this with yourself, if you close your eyes and try to walk in a straight line for some distance carefully, it's best to do this with a spotter so you don't crash into anything. But you'll notice everybody has kind of a natural bias to turn either to one direction or the other. And it's complicated to train that kind of natural bias out of yourself. So I've never thought about this at all, but I'm wondering if there might be some kind of connection between that kind of natural bias and movement to curve, and the kinds of things that you're describing, like ritual dances that you're right, are mm-hmm. are most often in circles.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much.
All right, well, thank you for the call. We'll go on and talk with someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello? Yes?
I'm thinking I've heard somewhere along the way that the bias you just described has to do with whether or not you're right-handed or left-handed. If you're right-handed, your right leg will probably... Your right, the stride of your right leg will be slightly longer than the left, or vice versa, or something like that. And I don't know if there's any truth to that or not, but I'm thinking I've heard that somewhere. Anyway, in your work, did you look into how people who live, shall we say, primitively, say Kalahari Bushmen, who live on plains, if they're brought into a forest, how they would react, you know, because they've lost all their normal reference cues and so on and so forth, and vice versa. You take a mud man from New Guinea someone who lives in one of the Aboriginal peoples that, say, live in the Amazon, who live in a forest where their vista is only just a few feet unless they come to water or something like that, and how they react differently if they're brought into a plain or a great open area and so forth. And also, my last question is, I heard somewhere along the way, and this may be a wives' tale, some legacy of our, it's thought to be a legacy of our hunter-gatherer roots, is that women don't tend to have the same spatial orientations, 3D orientations, or at least 2D orientations that males do, that men tend to be better at relating to where things are in the environment than women do, and so forth. Is there any truth to that at all, and or how does that play out, and so forth? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All fascinating questions. First of all, your observation about handedness and possibly footedness playing a role in people's intrinsic biases to turn in either one direction or the other. I think there is some basis to that kind of argument. One of the things that we know is that there are some interesting correlations between handedness and patterns of brain organization. What's interesting is that there's some evidence to suggest that those links between brain organization and body laterality may be stronger for the foot than they are for the hand. So one of the things that we think that we understand about those kinds of biases is that they, in part, may be coming about through interesting differences in hemispheric activation, just differences in activity in the two sides of the brain, which interestingly enough, you see in all kinds of different animals. And if you measure the turning biases of a laboratory rat, then again, typically you'll find that they are biased to turn in one direction more than the other, just in their spontaneous behavior. So first of all, yes, there does seem to be some basis to think that there might be links between patterns of brain laterality and these turning biases. Your second question had to do with taking people who may have grown up in one kind of wayfinding culture and moved to a different one. I suspect that there are such stories. I can't think of any that I know that involve those kinds of traditional wayfinding cultures. But what you're describing makes sense, that if you're attuned to a certain type of environmental signal, imagine that you grow up on open plains where you have grand vistas, you might be tempted to use astronomical information to find your way, patterns of stars, sun patterns, whereas if you're living in dense bush, those kinds of cues might be less useful than local landmarks. So I suspect that you would see the kinds of effects that you're describing. And I think that you see those kinds of effects in people who have moved from one kind of city plan to another. That's something that I was talking about earlier on, that there are many different kinds of city styles, and that those differences in style can affect us in all different ways, ranging from wayfinding to actually how we feel about the space that we occupy. So, and again, I suspect that you'd see those kinds of effects. Your last question had to do with gender, and I think that there is some evidence for gender differences, and I think that's an absolutely fascinating story that may in fact connect to our evolutionary antecedents. And the reason that I think that it may is because the story that's told of human beings in some ways is similar to the story that is told of the behavior of other animals. And the first thing probably the most important thing to say about gender differences in navigation as we understand them is that what has been found is that there are differences in navigation style between men and women. And now I'm talking about, remember that there's this huge variability. So everyone is different. Everyone has their own style, which can be a mix of using compass directions, using landmarks, maybe using other things as well. And that's very flexible. We can turn on different styles of navigation in different contexts to some extent as we need to. So there's that variability. But taking all of that variability into account, there is what looks like a measurable difference in cognitive style between men and women. And the nature of the difference seems to be that women, on average, tend to be superior at using landmarks, and men, on average, tend to be superior at using compass directions. And so what that means is that how well you can navigate, to the extent that you can base it on gender at all, and maybe you can just a tiny bit, is going to depend on the context in which you find yourself. If you're in a context where it makes good sense to be exquisitely attuned to features of your environment and to remember what things look like and to pay attention to visual detail, then landmark navigation on average is going to work better for you. But if you're in circumstances where you have access to information that you can use to compute compass directions, then maybe compass style navigation is going to work better for you. So overall, there are a number of different styles of navigation that work better or worse for different kinds of contexts, and yes, there does seem to be a little bit of a gender bias. Hmm.
We're coming into about our last 5 minutes, and there's a lot of interesting things here that unfortunately we won't have time to talk about. There is one thing that I do want to make sure that we get to, because I think it's one of the most interesting ideas in the book, and that is that the fact that human beings do get lost easily and don't have an instinctual sense of direction like some other animals has to do with a unique feature of our mind. And you say that it is. It has something to do with the fact that we can imagine ourselves being in some other space. We can even imagine imaginary spaces, spaces that don't really even exist. That's something that has given humans a very powerful ability to construct their environment, but there is something of a downside, and the downside may indeed be that, yes, we do easily get lost.
Yes, David, you've nailed it. And I think that's key. You know, one of the questions that I asked myself a lot as I began to kind of work out the science story as well, you know, why should it be the case that in comparison with the other animals that I've studied, we tend to sometimes fumble our way through space? What's the upside of that? And I think the upside is exactly what you've described, that we do have this phenomenal capability to imagine ourselves in spaces where we aren't currently, and to imagine spaces that don't contain us. So in a way that I think no other animal can, we can separate ourselves from our bodies from questions of space. And I think that's a tremendously powerful tool. If you think about what that means, then basically it means that we can, with incredible nimbleness, throw ourselves mentally through space and through time. And that means that we can plan. We can understand what a space will be like before we get there. We can understand what effect we will have on that space when we get there. And we can think about how we can change that and exactly as you've described, to build an environment. So I think the upside for us is that we have this phenomenal capability to leave the here and now and to think about the there and then. And that's what has allowed us to technologically master space and, for example, build rocket ships that can go to the moon. But the downside is that because we have this ability to leave the here and now, those kinds of distractions, those kinds of mental wanderings through space can sometimes cause us to become disoriented, to get lost.
We'll try to get one more caller at least in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Yeah, we have a compass plant on the prairie that is leaves face north and south to stop water being boiled out of the leaves. And early settlers were very dependent on that plant because they realized that if they went 100 miles in the prairie with no identification, they would be back on a doorstep. And so that's that leads to your point that people don't go in straight lines.
Yeah, it's quite phenomenal. People have great difficulty in walking a straight path, especially where, you know, it's not too bad. I suggested earlier that it can be fun to and informative to just close your eyes and try to walk in a straight line. That's not nearly as hard as, for example, going to a bit of forest and being sure that you're not going to get disastrously lost. But trying to set a course and maintain that course while having to take little detours around clusters of vegetation and that sort of thing, unless you're very well trained in those kinds of skills, you'll find yourself falling remarkably off course in a short period of time.
There are some animals that apparently have an internal biological compass. They literally have it inbuilt, and they know what way north is. Is there any evidence that some people might have some sense like that?
I know that there have been people who've tried to establish that there is magnetic field detection in human beings, and the story as I know it is very equivocal. There was a period of time during the 1980s when there was great excitement that this might be the case, and I know that the people who tried to do the follow-up studies had some difficulties replicating the original studies. So the state of play, as I understand it right now, is that there's no strong evidence that we do, but there's still occasionally there's anecdotal evidence suggesting that people have somehow pulled off magnificent feats of navigation, and there has been speculation that maybe they were using magnetic fields. But certainly the laboratory science and the studies as I know it suggest that there's not strong evidence that we can do it.
Sorry to do this to you, but in a minute, can you say something about the way we think about space and the way that we connect to the environment, and then how that maybe does or doesn't help us to think in positive, constructive ways about the quality of the environment?
I will try. I think that there's this converging idea among people who are trying to understand how it is that a species that has the wonderful capabilities that we have has been able to mess up its own environment as much as we have. And the converging idea seems to be that for perhaps a bunch of reasons, we have great difficulty connecting our actions with their consequences. We somehow have difficulty putting together cause and effect. So my argument in the book towards the end is that if you think about the lessons from how we do space, that we may not always have this very crystal clear understanding of where we are, then you can add to that argument this notion that we may be spatially disconnected from the consequences of our actions. So, for example, I can tell you that if you leave your let your car idle a lot in the city, then you're contributing to climate change. It's an intellectual argument that is not that hard to understand, but it is an intellectual argument. It's not an argument that you feel in your bones because you feel connected to the places where the effects of your actions might be taking place. So that's the connection that I try to draw between our disconnected, our fragmented understanding of space as human beings and our attitudes towards the environment. Mm.
There's lots more in this book that we've talked about. If you're interested, look for the book You Are Here, Why We Can Find Our Way to the Moon But Get Lost in the Mall, published by Doubleday, by our guest Colin Ellard. He's an experimental psychologist at University of Waterloo. That's in Ontario, Canada. And Professor Ellard, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Great questions.